Thanks for coming. I know it's basically Christmas is tomorrow, so I'm very happy you guys are all here. So I'm going to tell you about various directions and looking for very light bosonic particles around black holes. And we don't, probably in this crowd, we don't need much motivation to look for these new particles, but I just want to remind you that, you know, in the standard model, we have a range of scales that appear from very light to the neutrinos to very heavy like the top quark, and a lot of the new physics that we're looking for is usually associated with going to UV scales to higher energies at the LHC, future colliders, maybe dark matter. But there's a lot of interesting stuff to be looked for at very light masses, and some of those are motivated by also outstanding puzzles in the standard model. Probably the best known one is the strong CP problem for why the experimentally why the electric Doppler moment of the neutron is so small, or otherwise why the CP violation in the strong QCD sector is so small. So that motivates particles like the QCD axion, and then in more complete theories that go beyond the standard model, such as string theories or other models of extra dimensions, you often have many light new states that are associated with new directions in those extra dimensions, and those come with light particles like scalars that set the size and shape of the extra dimensions, or sometimes vector particles as well, and those tend to be those can be very light under some circumstances. And so these are the kind of signatures we'll be focusing on, in particular for the QCD axion. So this is the parameter space as it stands. I don't know why it's kind of low resolution. I need to fix this. Anyway, I apologize. If there's anything you can't read, let me know on the slide. So this is the FA, the UV scale associated with the axion, where some U1 symmetry is broken and the axion becomes a pseudo-Goldstone boson. It's a function of mass and EV. And the grayscale is the current bounds. So there's constraints from astrophysics. There's some experimental constraints. This is the QCD axion line, which has a one-to-one relationship between FA and the mass. But if we have, I mean, we're free to go anywhere in this plane. These are pseudo-Goldstone bosons, they're free to be very light and weakly coupled. In particular, if we wanted to be dark matter through misalignment production in the early universe, if you start with an order one misalignment angle, then there's a line on here which you get order one of dark matter. So there's a lot of motivated parameter space here, and we'll be focusing on very light guys. And I'll argue today that a lot of this parameter space can be covered both through gravitational and through direct detection probes. And since we're talking about very light particles, very light bosonic particles, I also want to, I'll make a few comments throughout the talk on vector particles, where you have, again, a parameter space of coupling versus mass. There's a lot of existing constraints already, assuming the gray are just generic constraints, the brown are assuming it's the dark matter. And we'll be looking for signatures at very light masses here. I think the slides are getting a bit cut off. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Can we shift this? Or is it going to get messed up? No? Okay. Okay, that's okay. Okay, I can tell you what things say if it's missing. Okay, so three parts. First, I'll introduce black hole superradiance and its process where you have a rotating black hole that loses energy and angular momentum to a cloud of very light bosonic particles whose wavelength, Compton wavelength, matches the size of the black hole. And there's two signatures, two classes of signatures. One are gravitational. So for example, since the black hole is losing angular momentum, the black hole spin will decrease, and measuring black hole spins astrophysically can tell us about the presence or absence of such particles. And you could, once you populate these huge occupations, these states with huge occupation numbers around black holes, there's also other signatures that appear. For one, they will source gravitational wave radiation that is now being searched for in LIGO data. And in the presence of self-interactions, as you would expect for axion-like particles, there are new dynamics in the cloud and also new signatures such as axion waves that can be detected in dark matter experiments. So if you're not already familiar with superradiance, this is a lightning kinematical introduction. So superradiance is a very old and established process, which is completely general. So it's the extraction of energy from a dissipative rotating object. So let's take a cylinder here with a kind of rough surface so that there's friction on the surface of the cylinder. And let's shoot a ball at it. Because there's friction, as the ball is traveling past the cylinder, it'll slow down and maybe even stop because it's losing energy. However, if we get the cylinder rotating, then at the point of contact, actually the ball will speed up as it extracts energy from the cylinder. In the frame of the ball, the cylinder grabs onto the ball and gives it a little push. So
it's almost invisible. Is it Doris Stavabinsky?
Yes, it's not invisible. It's not invisible on my slide.
What's the last one?
Misner.
Misner, yes.
Yes. So this was first pointed out by Zeldovich. Very generally, he calculated these rates for a rotating cylinder that had that has some non-zero resistivity to electromagnetic waves. Maybe that was Starobinsky. Anyway, one of the two of them. So this is very well known, and this can happen for any kind of rotating object that has some dissipation to the incoming wave. So a great example of a dissipative rotating object is a black hole. This is still a Zeldovich down here. So if you have a rotating black hole and you shoot a wave at it, the amplitude of the wave will increase if the angular velocity of the wave is small compared to the angular velocity of the black hole horizon. And one thing that I want to emphasize is that in the ball example, what happens is the ball's energy is increasing as it gains energy momentum from the cylinder. But here, what happens is that the amplitude of the wave is increasing, but the energy per particle is staying constant. So this is a one-time process, but it's been well established. So this is a numerical GR simulation by Will East, which is taking a black hole here, and you shoot gravitational waves at it with some angular momentum. So let's take this incoming gravitational wave is blue, and then through superradiance, it rescatters and gains amplitude. The outgoing wave is red. So you can see it's enhanced by a large amount as the black hole spins down a little bit and rescatters the wave. So that happens for any kind of bosonic wave that scatters from a black hole, but it's a one-time process. Even that amplification is not really enough to do anything to the black hole that would be observable. But Preston Tucholsky had this thought experiment, okay, let's surround the black hole by a perfect mirror and see what happens. In that case, this process happens over and over again. So you start with a photon with the right initial conditions so that its angular velocity is smaller than the angular velocity of the black hole. It goes past the black hole, gets amplified, gets reflected, the process repeats. And the growth becomes exponential because these are bosons, so the more photons there are in that state, the faster the growth rate. And eventually, the growth is so large that the radiation pressure inside the mirror becomes huge, and the mirror will explode. So this was called the black hole bomb, and that was the first example of where this kind of process could actually back react on the black hole in a significant way. Of course, that's not a very realistic example, but you can come up with a much more realistic case by introducing a small mass to the wave. So instead of trapping it by boundary conditions with a mirror, you trap it with a small mass. So let's take a boson whose inverse mass is comparable to the black hole size. Then there are bound states just through gravity, 1/r potential, that live very close to the black hole. And can have angular velocities that are of the right size, that are small compared to the black hole velocity. And those states will get automatically amplified by superradiance, so they'll extract energy from the black hole and increase in number. And the most efficient growth is exactly when these states are localized close to the black hole, but still well outside of the horizon, which means that the particle Compton wavelengths should be comparable to the black hole size, which means that we're looking for particles for stellar mass black holes that we can see in our galaxy. We look for particles that are order 10 to minus 11 or lighter electron volts. So this was studied kind of theoretically by many people for scalars around black holes, and then it was pointed out more recently that this can be used in realistic environments of astrophysical black holes to look for the QCD axion.
So it means that effective the Coulomb interaction or coefficient is one, right? I mean.
Yes. Yeah. So we'll be working with the case where it's a little less than one. So it's actually, if you apply the superradiance condition, you'll see that it has to be less than a half. And we'll be for black holes that are not extremal, so that are rotating with, say, spins of 0.9 or 0.8, it'll be 0.3 or less. So it's a good expansion. But people have also worked out cases where it's a half, and the story is similar. So this is exactly going to your point. So we have this potential, and let's make the analogy to a hydrogen atom so that we're all on the same page. So we have the fine structure constant, alpha nm, which is usually 1 over 137. Here it's this product of the mass times the size of the black hole, alpha, and then the radius is 1 over the mass of the axion and 1 over the coupling, which will be 4 to a few hundred RG, depending on the system we're looking at. And the differences are that now we have bosons, so we can have huge occupation numbers, unlike one electron per state. And I'll get to why those are the numbers that, why it's specifically 10 to the 75 to 10 to the 80, but that's what's giving us the kind of observable signatures of these clouds. And then boundary conditions are the other important distinction from a usual hydrogen atom, because now we have a black hole at the origin, so we and that's where the dissipation is coming from. So we impose that the wave function is only ingoing at the horizon, and that's what gives us this imaginary component to the energy levels. So we have the rest mass minus the binding energy, just like for an electron, but now we have this imaginary part which comes from dissipation at the horizon. It can be positive or negative, depending on whether superradiance, it can be positive or negative depending on whether the superradiance condition is satisfied. So for modes which are rotating with low velocities will grow, whereas modes that are counter-rotating, for example, will decay.
But it is like individual levels, like analog of hydrogen atom. So I mean,
yeah.
So this huge number, it means that it is occupation numbers this level?
Exactly, yes. So they're all in the same state.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Good, and yeah, please keep asking questions. So this is just a picture of what the energy densities would look like. These are the usual kinds of orbitals labeled by, you know, the hydrogenic numbers NLM. So this is something like a S orbital, a P orbital, and a D orbital for a scalar. For photons, for dark photons, there's an extra degree of freedom, which is the spin, and you can work out the spin spherical harmonics. So you can get bound states that look like a S orbital but have angular momentum and can superradiate. So the cool thing about this is that you can sit much closer to the black hole without having the angular momentum barrier, and so you can have much larger rates than for a scalar of the same mass. And so this is the spin vector of the photon will process around the, or will rotate around the black hole spin axis.
So in the L equals zero case for the vector,
yeah,
the wave function is large even in the black hole itself, or were you taking that expansion that the black hole is much smaller?
Yeah, so here the black hole is very small compared to the cloud. So in the black, so the boundary condition is that everything falls into the black hole at the horizon.
But you mean that like just incoming wave? You mean in distance?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, but usually this condition implies it's like
fall into the center, right? I mean, critical, so it implies that normally a particle would follow to the black hole?
Yeah, so if you just set up a non-rotating state, that it would fall into the black hole. But because of the rotation, there's a component of the wave function that actually is extracting energy. Yeah.
This imaginary part, the width would be what is eaten up by black hole. So, I mean, imaginary part would be coming in to the black hole, or is coming out? Is it coming?
Yeah. So if you calculate, so at the horizon, everything is going in. But if you look from infinity, then the wave function is growing.
Uh-huh.
Depending on the sign of the imaginary part.
Right, but it's growing, but you mean that there is some part of wave going out? Imaginary part should have kind of unitary interpretation, right, where it goes.
Yes, I think we're saying the same thing. So let's keep going and then...
I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. That was the setup, and let's see what happens to the black hole here. If you start with a black hole of a given mass and spin, it's cut off, but this is the spin from 0, which is Schwarzschild, to 1, which is extremal Kerr, and this is the black hole mass and solar masses. Let's say there's a particle of 6 times 10 to the minus 13 eV. These are the regions where you have super radiance, so where the sign of the imaginary part is such that the amplitude of the cloud is growing. And so this is for different bound states with quantum numbers 1, 2, and 3. And here, the super radiance condition is not satisfied. So if you set up a cloud, it would fall back into the black hole. So with these parameters, after 10 years, the black hole will spin down and form a cloud here by conservation of angular momentum. The amount of
but when you're saying it's growing up, you mean that it's geographically growing up, or
no, just the amplitude. So it's like a laser. You have more and more particles in the same state.
Right, but then why you would call it imaginary part? Right, it's probably
imaginary part of the energy.
Oh, the energy.
The energy.
The sign is still.
Here it's positive. It's e to the I gamma t.
Gamma is positive. Right?
Gamma is positive. Yes. Exactly. Yes. So it's populated this level, which has the same angular momentum as the black hole has lost. So if you calculate how much angular momentum that is.
Yeah, because I'm asking about sine of gamma.
Yeah.
Because when normally gamma implies that something is diminishing.
Yes. Here it's the other way. Exactly. So it's e to the plus gamma t, not e to the minus I gamma t.
Yeah.
Gamma t. No i's.
Yeah.
Okay. So here it's growing. Although it is important to also consider the states that could be decaying, but here we just want to look at the growing ones. And so 10 to the 77 particles here carry about as much momentum as order one of the black hole spin. So the black hole now has spun down so that its angular velocity is exactly matching the angular velocity of the particles. So super radiance will stop, so now gamma is 0. Okay. And then the next level will start to grow. I mean, it's technically been growing the whole time, but it's just parametrically slower. And here it takes about 10 to the 6 years. And the reason is that it's a larger angular momentum barrier, so it's further away from the black hole, so the energy extraction is less efficient.
The next level, meaning like L equals 2 super radiance condition is satisfied when you start. What does it mean?
Yes. So. Basically, it's easier to satisfy the super radiance condition for higher angular momentum levels because it's the velocity goes as the energy of the particle over m, where m is the angular number. So it's easier for it to be satisfied for higher levels. So here L equals 2 is satisfied. Here L equals 3 is satisfied. But the higher L is, the bigger the angular momentum barrier and the slower the rates are. So you go to the first one, the lowest L, which is the fastest, and then if you have time, you go to the next ones. Yeah. So at this point, you have two levels that are populated, and the first one is actually annihilating away to gravitational wave radiation, which I'll get to. And then in principle, the third level could start to grow, but that one is parametrically even slower, And so it's not going to make a difference observationally. Good. And then for dark photons, you can even live in this S level, which normally would have zero velocity and just fall into the black hole. But here, you can sustain it with the spin angular momentum, and all the rates are increased because for each angular momentum state, the wave functions are localized closer to the black hole. Okay. Is everyone on board with this? Yeah.
So this, I mean, this feels part of the story about the super radiance, you know, for axion, say, like, it's completely model independent, right? Like, it doesn't matter what other couplings the axion has.
Yeah, well, a little bit. So this is, so for the first half of my talk, I'll just be talking about it assuming just gravitational interactions. Right. So, and that's model independent in terms of, you know, as long as we have a particle with a mass and energy, GR tells us that it couples to gravity in a certain way. And
but the annihilation of the axions into gravitational waves.
Yeah, that's also model independent. Yeah, that's just through the regular gravitational
waves. Sure, right. I mean, if the axion has other coupling, say, to, I don't know, like a standard model or whatever, then it could, I mean, it could
do other things.
Those, perhaps.
Yeah, so you can't really, so that's exactly what's happening when you have self-interactions. So you can have axions going to other axions. You could have axions going to photons, but that's usually a decay. Right, so you can't have two axions going to a photon. You have one axion going to two photons, and because the reason why I'll get to it when I talk to gravitational waves, but the reason why the gravitational waves are potentially sizable is that there's a huge energy density, and there's two powers of that energy density that are sourcing the gravitational waves. Whereas if you have one axion decaying to two photons with a standard coupling at these masses, you'll get, you know, one photon every 70 years from one axion, so maybe you'll get one photon a year from the cloud since you have many, many axions. There are some other effects, like maybe you could have parametric resonance into photons, but I'm happy to talk about that maybe later, because it's, yeah. But in most of the parameter space that we're considering here, the photon interactions are very small. Okay. So let's get to the signatures. So like I said, I think, so here are the regions where super radiance is active, and for the black hole spin versus mass. And there's actual data points that are on this plot, which come from looking at black holes in X-ray binaries, so black holes that are accreting from a companion star, and looking at the properties of the accretion disk to infer the mass and the spin. And so you can see that many of these black holes are well within the superradiance regions where we would have expected, if there was a particle of, say, this mass, we would have expected these to have spun down to the bottom of these regions.
But this way, our experiment is verified that there is no superradiance in this case?
Yes, exactly. So this plot excludes this this particle mass. Yes, exactly.
What's the
So these are, the error bars are 90%. There's, of course, there's systematics, which from talking to the experimentalists are subdominant to the statistical error bars, but of course there's always that issue. So if you translate that to this parameter space, I'm sorry, again, it's cut off, but for axions, you get about a factor of 30 for each of these black holes. Each of these squares is one level. And for dark photons, you get a larger range of masses. Given that these black holes are rotating quite rapidly and they've been around for a while, we can exclude the existence of these axions.
So I should think of these blocks as 95% confidence.
So each one of these is a 95% confidence. The different blocks are different L levels. Yeah. So you can combine them if you like. I like showing them separately because someone might come along and say, oh, this black hole has some issue.
The plot for the dark photons spans a much wider, I mean, the constraints are span a much wider.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so the reason is that the super radiance rates are parametrically faster. So for axion, the rate goes as this alpha parameter, which is the ratio of the black hole size to the Compton wavelength to the, say, eighth power. For the first level, And that comes from the amount of wave function that's at the horizon. For vectors, instead of going as the eighth power, it goes as the sixth power because the wave function is closer. So, and these at the boundary here, the alpha is very small. It's like 10 to the 2 times 10 to minus 3. So that makes a big difference. Yeah. Yes.
So this is probably silly, but can you reassure me there's no issues with stability or something in the presence of an accretion disk?
Yes, I can. It's not silly. So if there's an accretion disk or a companion, you do get a perturbation to your to the solution that you're studying here, such as levels. For example, the easiest to understand is if you have a companion that induces a dipole and quadrupole moment potential, you can expand the potential in moments, and you can look at the contributions. It turns out that the dipole contribution doesn't contribute because basically it shifts the black hole and the cloud over together because of the equivalence principle. So that was pointed out by Bauman et al. For the quadrupole moment, that does cause level mixing. So you can mix a state that's growing to a state that's decaying, and that can disrupt the cloud. But that's part of what we checked for these bounds that only happens when the cloud is kind of big and fluffy. And so that can limit the parameter space for very small masses, but it's not. So this is actually, these bounds are actually maybe a little bit stronger than what's shown here. Yeah, but it's a good question. OK, so that's the constraints. You can also play this game with at LIGO because they measure spins. You have the two incoming black holes that are orbiting each other. Each has a spin. LIGO is not super sensitive to the amplitude of that spin, but it can measure it kind of to order one. And so with large statistics, you could hope to measure all of the initial spins of the black holes that are merging and find that there are no highly spinning black holes, and most of them are localized on these kind of super radiance boundaries where they spin down in the lifetime of the binary. So for a axion and for a dark photon, you'd expect kind of big gaps with overdensities on these super radiance lines. And that's something that we think with a few hundred events, which will come in 5 years' time, I think without a problem, you'll be able to do this analysis. And there's already a group of people at LIGO who did the analysis with the 10 events. And you know, it's not significant yet, but it's interesting. OK, any questions about this?
But it is implies that it's kind of huge number of black holes measured, or it's measured, right?
This is a cartoon.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is a cartoon. So far there's 10 data points on this.
10.
So this is a projection for the future.
It is in the future.
Yeah. This is for the future. And in the future or today, the error bar in each of these points is very large. I didn't show it because then it doesn't. I mean, you can't see what's happening, but they're kind of order one constraints. Yes?
So does the presence of the clouds have an effect on the
binary?
The waveform. On the spins that you would infer?
No, because by the time they're in the LIGO band, the cloud is long gone, either through annihilations or through being disrupted by what we just discussed. In principle, you could hope that you see it early enough. Especially when you have mid and low band gravitational wave detectors, you might see the cloud when it's still around the black hole before it's disappeared. But I think there's very little parameter space to see that at LIGO, although that question still needs to be studied properly. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so on to gravitational waves from the cloud itself. So going back to the atomic analogy, if you have two levels that are occupied simultaneously, which doesn't usually happen for this gravitational atom because each growth rate is a kind of parametrically different from another. But if you had two at the same time, then you could have transitions from an excited state to a ground state. And instead of emitting photons like you do for a hydrogen atom, you emit gravitons. The same thing can happen for annihilations to gravitons. So this is just usual vertex where you have two axions. But now they go to one graviton in the background of the black hole. You can conserve both energy and momentum because you have a distribution of momenta in the cloud because of the black hole in the middle. And these signals are coherent and monochromatic. There's a cloud which is in the same energy eigenstate, and all of the particles have the same phase. So these signals are very beautiful sine waves that are being emitted from the cloud.
But this would be kind of depleted the level or what?
Yes.
So the rate is not that big, otherwise it would be,
depleted
right away, right?
Yeah, exactly. So there's a kind of a parametric separation of timescales, which, you know, is a question of numbers, but the cloud grows first.
Yeah.
And then it gets slowly depleted through this process, which is parametrically slower than the growth time. And so depending on the parameters, depending on how closely coupled the axion is to the black hole, the decay time goes from order a day to millions of years or even longer.
Are there noise processes that contribute to line broadening here, so it would be purely monochromatic?
There can be, so there's, the short answer is no. So there can be modulations for sure, like if it's in a binary or something like that. There can be frequency drifts. So the main effect from a frequency drift is what is actually happening here is the frequency of the gravitational wave is twice the energy of the axion. It's not the mass, it's the energy. And so the energy has a binding energy component that is the binding energy to the black hole potential. But there's also self-binding energy. And so as the cloud depletes, the self-binding energy decreases. And so the overall energy increases. So there's a small positive frequency drift.
But it still would be mostly near to masses or whatever, right?
Yeah, it's very close to twice the mass, exactly. Yeah. But I'll show a bit more. But yeah, as far, so these are, so there are kind of long-time drifts that can occur, but there's, as far as I know, there's no broadening effects.
You don't get coupling to, say, the CMB or to the finite temperature of the black hole that would broaden the line?
No, these are all in a, these are all in an exact energy eigenstate, and those effects are tiny. I mean, you can think of these as just, for all intents and purposes, being gravitationally coupled. Yeah. But it's a good question. So these effects are very, the modulations of the frequency are very important observationally. So this is to convince you that this actually happens, so you can calculate it. You can also, in a more GR, so I was talking about it in the particle language, in the more general relativity language, you can just calculate the stress energy tensor, and you can see that there's a component that oscillates at twice the mass or twice the energy. So here I'm showing a simulation of the vector cloud. So you'll see there's a overall energy density, and you'll see there's a component that's oscillating, that's a subcomponent, and it's emitting this gravitational wave radiation. So this is, again, numerical work by Will East. Like we already discussed, it's twice the energy of the particle, and it's long-lasting and monochromatic. So this is to wake you guys up in case you're falling asleep. So you can see there's a subcomponent, which is proportional to the velocity squared, roughly, of the particles in the cloud. And that's the thing that's sourcing gravitational waves. And over time, the cloud will deplete because it's losing energy to the gravitational waves.
This cartoon is so good that you do not need to do experimental confirmation.
See, we found it.
We already see it. Right?
Exactly.
The parabola is the stress energy tensor?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The density. Okay. So we did some estimates of how many of these signals you would expect to see. So since they're very long-lasting, it's not, you don't really consider it an event like the merger at LIGO. It's more like you turn on your detector and either the signal's there or it's not there. So how many of these signals do we see? We think, based on some estimates of the population of black holes, you can see as many as thousands of signals at design sensitivities of LIGO. And maybe the most optimistic numbers you would have already expected to see in the initial LIGO run, so that's why this is shaded, but that's kind of a cartoon. And then there's some kind of corner cases where you do see transitions, where for very high angular momentum levels, sometimes There's two principal quantum numbers that have comparable superradiance rates, so they grow together, and then they can have transitions in between them. But that's usually a coincidence, so the rate of that happening is small. And this is the range that's disfavored by the measurements of the black hole spins that I already talked about. So these are the kind of motivation for LIGO to be doing these sorts of data analyses. And in fact, they already have something that's similar, which is looking for rotating neutron stars. So if you have a neutron star which is not perfectly axis symmetric, then it'll also emit monochromatic gravitational radiation. And so those are searches that are being done by what's called the continuous waves group. And we've been talking to a bunch of people there, and they're trying to repurpose them for looking for these kinds of signals. Question?
Sorry, I don't
know. Yeah, please, no. Yeah.
The y-axis, you're saying if there are this many sources within some...
Sorry, let me back up. So, good. So here we're looking at, let's take a population of black holes in the Milky Way. We expect there to be between 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8 black holes, based on, you know, how many stars go supernova. And so those will have some distribution in the galaxy, some distribution of masses and spins. The spins are really not well understood, so here we're taking a range of assumptions about the spins from like a flat distribution to a more pessimistic one to a more optimistic one. And so for each of those black holes, when it's born, it'll grow a cloud if it can, depending on the mass. And then that cloud will source some signal with a particular amplitude and a particular length. And so if that lifetime is, you know, shorter than the age of the black hole, or sorry, longer than the age of the black hole, and if the strain is bigger than LIGO sensitivity, then we call that an event.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. So what do these events actually look like in the LIGO detector? So here we're looking at the strain as a function of frequency for two different masses, 4 times 10 to minus 13 and 8 times 10 to minus 13 eV. So here is the twice frequency, which is twice the mass, which here is around 193 hertz. As you increase the mass of the black hole, the binding energy increases, so the frequency decreases. And here's 5 solar masses, here's 20 solar masses. As you increase the size of the black hole, also the alpha increases, so all of the rates increase, and in particular, the strain gets larger. So you start seeing signals once the black hole, say, you have black holes that are 10 solar masses, so each of these dots would be a signal at the detector. These are curves of the strain as a function of frequency for different parameter assumptions. And so the same thing for a heavier boson, you'd see more signals. So these are signals in the detector frame. So you expect many, many signals. Sorry, these are signals in the source frame. So you expect many signals that are clustered around twice the mass of the boson, with more larger amplitude going to lower frequencies, and then gets cut off either because we don't expect there to be very heavy black holes, heavier than, say, 20 or 30 solar masses in our galaxy, or because eventually the signal time gets too short, and then we don't see it anymore. Yes?
Is there a regime where any one event is too small to see, but just if there's many of them, they add stochastically?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's also, so if you can, doing a kind of monochromatic search is better, but in principle, you could also do a stochastic search, and I think maybe one of these, I think maybe that one was doing a stochastic search for these types of signals, so you could do that as well. And you need to also repurpose it for, you know, it's stochastic, but in a very narrow band.
Or line.
Yeah.
Can you bring up the next slide?
Yeah.
Just hard to read the numbers.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
The strain's 10 to the minus 4 in the middle, roughly?
So this is 10 to the minus 25 to 10 to the minus 23. So then the lines will, so then these shapes will also get a bit smeared out by Doppler shifts. So they'll turn into these more like pyramid shapes where you have bigger amount of broadening at weaker signals, because those correspond to faraway black holes that have larger relative motion to us. So this is the kind of thing you would expect to see in the detector. So this is the same. So these are these two masses. So this is from a simulation of 10 to the 8 black holes in the Milky Way that have been run through the whole pipeline, and what kinds of strains you'd expect to see for these different masses. So this is, again, 10 to minus 25 to 10 to minus 23. And so given the kinds of searches that are, the sensitivity of searches that are being done for these continuous waves, these are the numbers of detectable signals that we'd expect with data that's on tape right now, runs 1 and 2, so now LIGO's in run 3, so this is already recorded. So these are projections, these are not events that they've seen. So as a function of axion mass from 10 to the minus 13 is here. So the 10 to minus 12 to 4 times 10 to minus 12, you could see as many as 1,000 events depending on mass and spin distribution. So these are flat spin distributions from 0 to 1. This is flat from 0 to 0.5. These ones are flat from 0 to 0.3. So if all black holes are born fairly slowly rotating, you might hope to see a few events. But if it's anything higher than that, then you would definitely see some signals.
And what's the excluded range at the moment?
So in principle, you could exclude, you mean from the spins. So it's about like here to, yeah. So from here, from say 5 times 10 to the minus 12, from 0.5 times 10 to minus 12 all the way to the right of this plot. Yeah, so these are currently mostly sensitive in the excluded region. It's hard to go beyond to the right because those frequencies are outside the LIGO band, but you can definitely kind of check the excluded region and also go a bit to the left. Yeah. And so in principle, you could also do discovery or exclusion with this. So you could, given assumptions about the black hole distribution, you could exclude, say, 2 times 10 to minus 13 to 3 times 10 to minus 12. However, the our continuous waves colleagues are telling us that right now that's not possible because with the searches they're doing, because unlike the neutron stars, which is kind of one signal in their whole band, here we see this whole cluster of signals. So for example, if you have a very narrow frequency range, this is the LIGO noise floor. These are the signals that we would add. So it looks like some kind of extra noise in the detector at some frequency. And if they pass this through their usual pipeline, this may or may not register as an actual signal because they add together in a way that if you increase the integration time, you don't necessarily, the signal to noise doesn't increase in the way that you expect because there's too many signals per band. So in principle, so there's two things to do. First is to decrease the binning, which is already happening. And the second is just to, you know, run this whole thing through the entire pipeline and check the efficiencies. And that's also for the future. So right now we can't place an exclusion, but it's very promising in terms of the rates. Good. Any questions on the gravitational wave stuff? I also got a bit freaked out when I was putting the year 20 in my projected archive numbers. Yeah.
You're waiting for special day?
No, we were hoping to put it out this year, but now everyone's disappearing on holiday, so early January. Yeah. So this is for more future detectors. You can also do a very cool follow-up search, which is that you know there's a new black hole that's formed from a merger somewhere on the sky. You know the mass and the spin of the merger, and then you could predict what the signal would look like from a given axion or photon cloud, and you could follow it up. Now, the the strain of these signals is much smaller than the merger strain, so you don't see most of them, which is why these event rates, so these are now event rates actually per year. How many mergers are close enough and loud enough, both in the merger and in the superradiance signal, that you would see both. So with current LIGO, it's maybe order one, but with future observatories, you could get dozens or hundreds of signals where you can correlate the two. So that would be very cool. And that's also being pursued. There's, you know, people are designing what kind of pipeline you want for these things at LIGO. So that's the gravitational wave story. Now let's move on to what happens when you have interactions. And let's just talk about a very simple interaction, which is a quartic axion coupling. If you have the usual cosine type potential for an axion, you'd expect both a mass and a quartic term. And here we've been talking about this range of parameter space where the quartic is about 10 to the minus 81. So you could say like, oh, okay, well, that's silly. Why are we even talking about it? But of course, there are huge occupation numbers. So actually, the quartic can be important. So the typical amplitude A over F of the axion field can be 0.1 or so, or even larger. So the quartic terms become important. So let's see what happens. So there's two potential things that happen. First is because of the quartic self-interaction, there's an extra attractive potential, which basically changes the equilibrium value of the cloud, the equilibrium radius of the cloud. And eventually, if the self-interactions become too large, the cloud contracts and contracts, and eventually there's a runaway process and it collapses. And that's what was called the bosonova, which was studied in the early papers and also was seen at some large values of coupling and simulations where you release the burst of axions as the cloud is collapsing. So this is kind of a non-perturbative effect. There's also some linear effects where you have the existing cloud of axions can be a source term for new axions to grow. In particular, you can use one level to populate a different level, which creates kind of new classes of signatures and new types of dynamics in the cloud. So previously, I was telling you that in the gravitational picture, you have one level occupied at a time. You do one, and then you do two. But here, you can have cloud one be actually a source for cloud two. And in particular, you can take particles that have angular momentum one, take two of them. That gives you one axion with angular momentum two, and one axion falls back into the black hole. Or you can have once you have level two populated, you can have two of these giving you one in the original state and some waves going off to infinity. And the fact that these processes can reach an equilibrium level, equilibrium kind of occupation level, was pointed out by Andrei Gruzinov a couple years ago. So you can, in the limit of very large coupling, you can actually have a steady state occupation value of axions. There we go. So just to walk you through what happens, this plot is a bit busy, but so let's look at the two axes. We have the self-interaction, FA. So this is Planck scale here, and then becoming stronger and stronger. So this is 10 to the 11. Here's the mass. The QCD axion is down here, so it's not really affected by these processes. If you have axion dark matter, it'll be somewhere here. So as you increase the self-interaction, the first thing that happens is that the first level will source the second level. So as a function of time, the first level grows, and then eventually it's kind of leaking axions into the second level and starts to catch up. As you increase the self-interaction further, the first level grows to maximum value, but the second level can catch up more quickly, and then there's this kind of quasi-equilibrium as a function of time. And then
what's the decay?
The decay, so there's two things. Here the decay is just axions going off to infinity. And there's also the fact that the black hole is spinning down, so your energy source is decreasing. Yeah. So here you have here the first level just barely grows to maximum before the second level catches up. And then finally, they're kind of co-growing together. So the first level never actually extracts all of the energy of the black hole. And they reach this quasi-equilibrium. And then this is the black hole spinning down the envelope here. So that's this point in the parameter space. And then if we go even further, then basically the occupation number is so small compared to maximum, say 10 to the minus 7, that the spin down of the black hole is very inefficient. And over the whole age of the universe, the black hole basically doesn't spin down, but is just slowly cycling energy into the cloud, which is then outputting it to axion waves at infinity. So that's this point here.
So is this, are those two processes at the bottom always preventing the boson nova?
So yes, so we won't be able to answer that question for sure because kind of by definition, it's a non-perturbative effect. So in the regions where we can calculate analytically, the answer is yes. So you always cap the size of the cloud before you get to this collapsing regime. But in this kind of pink region, we can't calculate analytically. And so there, it looks like kind of the occupation number is getting close to the numbers you need for the bosonova. So I think you'll need to do numerics to really understand. But for most of the place where you have signals, you typically have this linear regime.
But this would be also kind of decaying. I mean, does it compete with this gravity?
Yeah.
I mean, no, of course, it depends on the direction. But
yes, exactly. So this is another way for the cloud to lose energy. And so if the interaction is big enough, then you'll cut off the gravitational wave signals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'll get to that in a second. So the first thing that happens, of course, is, as I was saying, the black hole doesn't spin down as fast. So this is the black hole spin as a function of time. So if you're down here and the first level grows to maximum, then the black hole still spins down in the usual amount of time. But as you keep cranking up the self-interaction, the black hole spins down more and more slowly. And if you translate that to the bounds, so sorry, this is cut off, but this is M Planck over FA, so this is FA of 10 to the 19, this is FA of 10 to the 12 here as a function of mass, and here you have the different black holes as a function of coupling and mass, and these are their error bars on each black hole's mass and spin measurement. So basically everything below this curve will be excluded, and here you can see these extend a bit further out because the mixing effect from the companion is not as strong as we thought, but this depends now on the uncertainty of the age of the black hole. So now you can place bounds pretty robustly as in the FA-MA plane, and everything that's strongly coupled enough is not going to be excluded. And then as you were asking, you can look at the gravitational wave signals. So for example, this is the strain as a function of time. The blue is when it's gravitationally coupled. So this is the strain for that's almost constant for a long period of time. But now if you turn up the self-interaction, the maximum strain is the same, but now it falls off much faster because you have these axion waves. If you translate that to event rates, you see that there's for gravitational self-interactions, the event rates are what we had before, and now if you turn up the self-interactions by a factor of 30, they start decreasing, basically because the signal length is shorter, so you're less likely to catch an event happening at a given time, and then they start decreasing even further because even the peak of the signals is reduced. So this is the reach in kiloparsecs. So for gravitationally coupled axions, it's quite large, and then it gets reduced for stronger self-interactions. So that's the sad news. The happy news is that there's new signals. So now that you have two levels at a time, you can have You can have transitions between the two levels, say between a level with angular momentum 1 and a level with angular momentum 2. So this is the reach as a function of mass for transitions. So for moderate self-interactions, say of 10 to the 17 GeV or so, you can see the whole galaxy in transitions at LIGO. But these gray regions here are black hole masses lighter than one solar mass, black hole masses heavier than 50 solar masses, where we don't really expect to see many black holes. So LIGO is not really the best detector for these kinds of signals, because since they're transitions, now instead of taking the whole rest energy of the axion, it's a splitting. So it goes as like a fine structure alpha squared value of the energy. So it goes to lower frequencies for the same axion parameters. So now you want some intermediate band gravitational wave detectors that can pick up millihertz energies. And these things are being constructed at Fermilab. So these reach lines are the same values of the self-interaction for MAGIS, which is an atomic interferometer, which is looking for gravitational waves. So the upper bands are for the space-based MAGIS, which is, you know, futuristic. But the lower bands are for ground-based MAGIS, which is something like that's being constructed in Fermilab right now. So this would be an interesting target for these kinds of detectors.
Do you think you see the axion on this plot too? Or because this is mass and FA independent, but on the QCD axion line, where would it lie?
So for the QCD axion, at least for this range of black holes, what happens is it's in a range of parameter space which is not really affected by self-interactions, because either the self-interactions are too small or the gravitational coupling is large enough that before the second level can grow, the first level is depleted through gravitational waves. So this is typically for non-QCD axion parameter space, but we still have to look at all the corners and check. Yeah. Okay, and then last but not least is that there's also scalar waves that are being produced through these interactions. And the cool thing about this is that if you turn up the self-interactions, the cloud size will decrease. Right, there's these equilibrium occupation values, which get smaller and smaller as you increase the self-interaction. But typically for axions, the relevant parameter is the scalar field amplitude over FA. So even though the cloud size is decreasing, the value of theta, say, in the cloud is staying constant as you continue to crank up the self-interaction. So this is the value of theta on Earth from a nearby black hole as a function of time. For very weakly interacting axions, it's negligible. But as you crank up the self-interactions, you get a constant flux of axions that are streaming by that were created in the black hole. So you could try to look for them in experiments that have been designed to look for dark matter axions. For example, you can have interactions between the axion and spins of nuclei. And there are experiments that are currently starting to get implemented, like CASPER, looking for very light axions, or Ariadne, which is looking for axions that are sourced by a nearby rotating source, but in principle could also do data analysis to look for these kinds of signatures. So if you have these axions coming from a black hole, they would cause an energy splitting of this order of magnitude between different spins. And if we take some parameters, some optimistic parameters for sensitivity, you could see signals above this red line in a three-year experiment, which is scanning over this range. And these are the black holes that we were previously using to exclude the axions. But now, if the self-coupling is big enough, then we could actually use them to detect axions. So these are very close, and of course it depends on what the coupling of axions is to nuclei. So for example, if the axion coupling to nuclei is a factor of 10 bigger, then you could easily see some of these axion waves. Or if we look for some hypothetical black holes that are a bit closer, like within a half a kiloparsec, then you would also see these types of signals. So you have this black hole, which is spinning down. It's populating the cloud with one level. That level is now populating a second level and shooting off axions to infinity. So the cloud is like a conversion machine from energy in the black hole to axion waves that can then be detected on Earth, which I think is very cool. And these signals basically just last forever, because if the self-interaction is very small, the back reaction in the black hole is negligible. So you just have a constant axion wind that's being produced. So that's something to look for in these future dark matter detectors. And I'm running out of time, so I'll stop there. Thank you. More questions?
But it was like experimental talk. What about the theory?
Well, the theory, I can show you more details of the calculations if you want. So basically, a lot of the kind of the difficult calculations are mostly for the gravitational waves. I don't know if that's what you mean by theory. But you have to compute the gravitational waves that are emitted from the cloud, and there's some non-trivial cancellations because the frequency of the gravitational waves is high compared to the cloud size. So you have to take into account the fact that there's curvature around the black hole and things like that. But of course, I'm not making any kind of fundamental physics breakthroughs here. So sorry. Yes.
In asymmetrical black holes, can you get parametric amplification of any kind, or some sort of laser-like amplification that would be a lot beaming in a situation like this?
So there's not really beaming per se. The emission of these waves is not spherically symmetric. So the gravitational waves at leading order quadrupole, actually it's a little bit different from a quadrupole because they're like spheroidal harmonics, but first order they're quadrupole, and there's also higher moments. These ones go as YLM, M equals 3, L equals 3. So there's some beaming, like order 1, and that's set by the axis of the black hole exactly. So that's what breaks the symmetry, but it's order 1. But you do have to, when you do the LIGO searches, you have to take that into account. Yeah.
On the ELF dark matter line,
yeah.
Are you ever in a regime where for the ELF dark matter line, is the dark matter abundance smaller or larger than the black hole signal?
It's always larger.
The dark matter signal is?
It's larger.
Yeah, in some cases where, depending on F, the black hole signal could be larger, right?
Yeah, that's a good question. We have to plug in the numbers. So, if the dark matter is, if it's really 100% of the dark matter, then there's definitely much more energy density in the dark matter, just because, there's more dark matter than baryons, and there's more baryons than black holes. You win a bit because these are semi-relativistic. So if you have a gradient coupling, then you win by a factor of say 100, because the velocity is larger. So I think you would expect to see the dark matter first, if it's there, probably.
Okay. Yeah, I think I misunderstood one plot thing.
What I was trying to say, maybe here, is, yeah, so if you're, so this is as a function of FA, it's changing, right? But what I'm saying is that the experiments are shooting for this dark matter, A over FA for the QCD axion.
Yeah.
So if they, you know, if they achieve their goals of trying to look for the QCD axion, they'll also be able to see some part of these classes of signals. This is just for comparison in case you're not used to what A over FA is. Yeah, thanks. Okay?
Okay, so there's no more questions.